This is VOA News by remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. More than 332,000 people have died from COVID-19 globally, and the number of infections is well over 5.1 million. The U.S. death toll from the virus is approximately 95,000, while the number of confirmed infections is nearly 1.6 million. U.S. officials are invoking a rarely used provision of American law to help keep the country from again running out of medical supplies in a pandemic. The government is seeking to enter into a cooperative agreement with industry for personal protective equipment and medicine in the future under a section of the Defense Production Act that allows the sharing of competitive information without violating antitrust regulations. The Federal Emergency Management Agency is holding an initial meeting with the private sector representatives discussing the agreement. The U.S. scrambled to acquire PPE from around the world in early stages of the nation's COVID-19 outbreak. President Donald Trump and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell huddled at the White House to consider next steps in coronavirus aid. Republicans want to phase out unemployment benefits to encourage Americans to go back to work. Reconsideration of jobless aid is fast becoming the focus of debate over the next virus aid package. After the House passed a new sweeping $3 trillion aid package, U.S. senators faced mounting pressure to act before leaving town for a week-long Memorial Day break. The number of Americans applying for unemployment benefits in the 2 months since the coronavirus took hold in the U.S. has swelled to nearly 39 million. The government reported this Thursday, even as states from coast to coast gradually reopened their economies and let people go back to work. More than 2.4 million people filed for unemployment last week in the latest wave of layoffs from the business shutdowns that have brought the economy to its knees. More at VOAnews.com. This is VOA News. General Motors says it's gradually restarting operations at engine and transmission plants at two of its four manufacturing complexes in Mexico. The Mexican government had said that auto companies could start preparatory work for reopening May 18th, but that a full reopening would not occur until June 1st. But General Motors Mexico said in a statement that it will start operations Friday at one motor plant in the northern state and an engine and transmission plant in the central state. U.S. officials have pressured Mexico to allow MEC factories to resume operations after shutdowns to stem the spread of the coronavirus. The war of words between China and the United States escalated on Thursday, with China's foreign ministry spokesman saying U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo had bankrupted his credibility to the world with numerous lies. It comes after Pompeo said on Wednesday that the recent treatment of pro-democracy activists in Hong Kong made it more difficult to assess that the territory remains highly autonomous from China, a requirement for the special treatment it enjoys under American law. The Chinese Foreign Ministry's Office of the Commissioner to Hong Kong said in a statement Thursday that Pompeo was blackmailing the Hong Kong government and blatantly interfering in Beijing's internal affairs. The Georgia man who filmed cell phone video of the fatal shooting of Ahmaud Arbery has now been charged with murder. The Georgia Bureau of Investigation said Thursday that 50-year-old William Roddy Bryant has been arrested on charges of felony murder and criminal attempt to commit false imprisonment. Arbery was slain February 23rd after a white father and son armed themselves and pursued him after spotting the 25-year-old black man running in their neighborhood. Bryant lives in the same subdivision, and the video he took from the cab of his vehicle helped stir a national outcry when it leaked online. A sharply divided U.S. Senate confirmed John Ratcliffe as Director of National Intelligence Thursday, with Democrats refusing to support the nomination over fears that he will politicize the intelligence community's work under President Donald Trump. All Democrats opposed Ratcliffe, making him the first DNI to be installed on a partisan vote since the position was created, and in the year 2005, the tally was 49-44. Ratcliffe will take over the agency at a tumultuous time. The nation faces threats from Iran and North Korea, Russian disinformation campaigns to interfere in the U.S. elections and tensions with China over rising competition and the spread of the coronavirus. And again, back to the coronavirus, more than 332,000 people have died from COVID-19 globally. The number of infections is well over 5.1 million. More at VOAnews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Friday, May 22nd. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Malawi's Mbatho Electoral Commission Chairperson, Jane Ansa, has resigned.
Dr. Jane Ansa has not been influenced by any external pressure, and that is not her reason to step down.
Meanwhile, a parliamentary committee has endorsed June 23rd for the presidential election rerun. But the main opposition says the current electoral commission cannot be trusted to supervise the vote. Herbal cures for COVID-19 are spreading in Tanzania without evidence that they work. And Burundians are with presidential election results as the main opposition candidate claims fraud.
These elections were held in a likely state of emergency where police and security officers were given specific orders which were meant to suppress mostly people from the opposition.
Agathon Rwasa is Burundi's main opposition candidate. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's post are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Malawi's Mbatho Electoral Commission Chairperson Jane Ansa has resigned. She told the Malawi Broadcasting Corporation Thursday night that she has written to President Peter Mutharika to inform him of her decision. Ansa and her fellow commissioners have been under public pressure to resign after Malawi's Constitutional and Supreme Court canceled the 2019 election results, saying they were marred by fraud and mandated fresh elections. Malawi Information Minister Mike Botomani says Ansa did not resign because of public pressure.
I can confirm, at least based on what I have monitored on the national television, that Dr. Jane Ansa has written the appointing authority, and that is the president of this country, His Excellency Professor Arthur Peter Mutharika, of her desire to resign before her time ends. So indeed, she has put it across in that way that she has resigned.
As you know, Justice Jane Ansa has been under pressure from demonstrations for her to step down. Did she say this was her reason for resigning?
Dr. Jane Ansa has not been influenced by any external pressure, and that is not her reason to step down, because she has actually said that she did not give any attention to the, you know, pressure or demonstrations that have been happening. All she has done is just to reflect on the current events, particularly on the court judgments, both from the Constitutional Court and the Supreme Court of Malawi. And after reflecting on that, she has decided to resign.
What's next now for President Mutharika? As you know, the term of the commissioners is expected to expire at the end of June. Does this mean that President Mutharika is going to appoint new commissioners?
Let us wait and see what the president is going to do. Obviously, we cannot preempt whatever decision that the president is going to make. But what is obvious is that we will need commissioners for them to take care of the events around preparations for the next elections. So let us wait and see.
Mike Botomani is Malawi's information minister. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. In another election-related development in Malawi, a parliamentary committee has accepted a recommendation by the Electoral Commission to hold the court-ordered presidential election rerun on June 23rd rather than July 2nd, as previously planned. Kesi Msukwa, chairperson of the Legal Affairs Committee, says the decision will now go to the full parliament to accept or reject.
The reason why the Legal Affairs Committee of Parliament decided to set the date of 23 June instead of 22nd of July is that in its ruling, the court decided that the elections of the president must be done and the president must be sworn in before the 151st day after the 3rd February ruling of the Constitutional Court. We know our Constitution requires that it has to take about 8 days before an announcement of the results. We have therefore taken cognizance of that so that the elections can be done on the 23rd, allow for some 8 days of counting and announcement of results before the 151st day we have a president sworn in.
Is your decision setting the date for June 23rd
final, or can the court overrule your decision?
The 23rd of June is not like the final decision, because Parliament has got to pronounce itself on the matter. The Legal Affairs Committee will report to Parliament on its recommendation, and it is Parliament that will be able to sustain the day or not. And after doing that, we have to send the bill again to the President for assent. You recall that the first time we did this, we had said 19th of May when we should have held the election, but the President withheld the assent. So that's why we are up to this juncture. But now it has to go back to Parliament, and Parliament will probably pass and send the bills to the President for assent.
Did your committee take into consideration the demand for members of this electoral commission to step down?
Thank you very much. We did not actually look into the question of them resigning, because we had noted right from the word go that they're not interested in talking about anything to do with the resignation. But we are cognizant of the fact that their terms of office end on the 5th June of this year.
When do you expect for the entire parliament to announce the date for the special election?
In an event that the parliament accepts the date, they'll pass it into a bill. But if they don't, they'll have to set their own date as parliament. In this particular case, we are in a very, very precarious situation, actually, in Malawi, regarding the way the law operates, particularly so where the president, who is also an interested party, has got to put a pen to it. We do only hope that the president will be able to see that this is an important issue regarding Malawians, and we should be able to put pen to paper.
That was Honorable Ketsi Umtsukwa, chairperson of the Legal Affairs Committee of the Malawi Parliament. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. The opposition, however, says it will not accept the current leadership of the Electoral Commission to supervise the election. MCP spokesperson Maurice Muntale tells viewers Peter Clotty that the current leadership of the commission cannot ensure transparency and credibility of the election.
We have no problems with the shifting of dates from 2nd of July to 23rd of June. Our only problem is Jane Ansah and her commissioners, because these people have been proven incompetent by the High Court, they have been proven incompetent by the Parliament of Malawi, and they have been proven incompetent by the Supreme Court of Malawi. Otherwise, as an alliance, we are ready, even if they said we are going to vote in a week's time. But we would not be happy, we would not be satisfied in our hearts to see Jane Ansah run these affairs again.
So barring any court decision to prevent the chairperson of the Malawi Electoral Commission from organizing this election, it appears Dr. Jesse Jane Ansah will still administer the presidential election rerun. What is your recourse if you are pushing or kicking against her organizing this election?
The only reason Jane Ansah and her team are still there is because they are so arrogant, they are portraying impunity of highest order, and we don't even know who they are serving, because those people are in those positions and are in that institution upon the people's trust. And that trust evaporated long time ago, so we don't know exactly who they are serving. We are never going to boycott the elections, even if Jane Ansah was there, because we know the Grand Alliance is going to win. With that one, we have no doubt at all. But we are going to go into the elections. If Jane Ansah is going to be there, we are going to go there under protest, because she knows that Malawians don't want her. They have no trust in her.
But Maurice, the president, incumbent President Arthur Peter Mutharika, says that Dr. Justice Jane Ansah has not broken any laws for which she should be sacked, as you have demanded.
I don't even know what type of law Peter Mutharika is referring to, because if a whole high court has proven the institution incompetent and a whole parliament has done the same, and the whole Supreme Court has said they are incompetent, who is Peter Mutharika to say they have done nothing wrong, as if this country belongs to him alone? Let institutions be honored, be respected, and be obeyed. Because if you say no to the judiciary, if you say no to parliament, then we are becoming a lawless country.
Maurice, does that mean with your strong opposition to the composition of the leadership of the Electoral Commission to organize this presidential election rerun mean that you will dispute the outcome of the presidential election rerun?
What we are disputing right now is the composition of the MEC itself. And if the MEC is compromised, then you can only expect compromised results. So it's not just a matter of refuting the results, but it is a matter of having the right people to run the electoral affairs. So that's what we are saying. I mean, we cannot say anything about the results now, but what we're saying now is that those who are running the electoral affairs are incompetent, and that's what we're looking at.
Maurice Mutale is the chairperson for the main opposition Malawi Congress Party. He was speaking with VOH Peter Clotty from the capital, Lilongwe. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, May 22nd. Burundians are awaiting results from Wednesday's presidential election to choose a successor to longtime leader Pierre Nkurunziza. But main opposition candidate Agathon Rwasa is claiming early victory. He tells viewers Edward Rima that preliminary results from his party's polling officers indicate he is winning. But Rwasa says the election was also marred by fraud to favor the ruling party candidate.
First of all, these elections were held in a likely state of emergency where police and security officers were given specific orders which were meant to suppress mostly people from the opposition and seemed to be siding the ruling party. I can corroborate this by some few examples. Where many representatives of our party in the polling stations were arrested and put in custody and were hurriedly sentenced for whatsoever. One has also to remember that the internet connection were cut as well or all of the social media so that they could be rigging without anyone communicating to another throughout the country. And even with the international community. It is clear that rigging was planned and anyone would have got a role to play in that rigging. Unfortunately, we could leave that date of yesterday and we went to the polls. And the trend is that ZNA is leading for presidential, parliamentary, and even communal in general.
Mr. Rwasa, you're saying that preliminary numbers that you have from your polling officers indicate that you're leading, but you've also talked of incidences of voter rigging and voter intimidation. If the results come and the other candidate of the ruling party has won, are you willing to accept the results?
We will consider all these environments and compare the results we would have compiled with those proclaimed by the CENI. If we found it is okay, there is no problem. But if we find that it is controversial, we will use what is in the electoral code and go to the court. It's my appeal to all Burundians to be more patriot and consider Burundi as the priority in any decision and respect the say of the people through the ballot.
Agathon Rwasa is Burundi's main opposition candidate in Wednesday's presidential election. He was speaking with viewers Edward Rayman from Bujumbura. In Tanzania, there has been a surge of claims for herbal cures for the coronavirus. Despite endorsements by some public officials, medical experts warned that no treatments should be taken at face value until scientifically tested. Charles Kumbe reports from Dar es Salaam.
At her farm on the outskirts of Dar es Salaam, Mwajuma Saidi collects peppers, mango leaves and other ingredients to steam and prepare what she believes is a cure for COVID-19. Her granddaughters are taking it too, even though they are not sick. Mwajuma says they just do it as a precaution. They did it for almost 4 days, then they stopped. She says they also took lemon, ginger, pepper, and onions, then blended them and put it all in a bottle. She asked that they started using it in the morning, afternoon, and evening for 4 days, and then they stopped. There's no evidence Mwajuma's portion does anything to combat the coronavirus, nor any others that have been touted. but the number of people in Tanzania who claim to have discovered a cure for the novel coronavirus keeps rising. Some are pushing an untested herbal potion, among them Hamis Malebo, who discovered Covidol.
Tokea tumeibundua.
He says since they discovered the herbal cure, it has been used by a few people, and among those who used it, they have seen some success. Hamisi adds, firstly, they have seen it lower fever faster, it fights respiratory problems, influenza, and body fatigue, things that emerge in this disease. Authorities say any coronavirus treatments need to be challenged first under strict clinical trials to see if they are effective. Yunus Mgaya is the Director General of the Institute for Medical Research. He says what they're waiting for are instructions from the General Secretary so they can include the herbal medicine in their research. Meanwhile, Mwajuma and her granddaughters continue to do their best to protect themselves from the virus, even though they are unsure if their concoctions actually work. Charles Kombe for VOA News, Dar es Salaam.
In Ghana, the COVID-19 pandemic has spurred people to adopt innovations in healthcare, from apps that help diagnose coronavirus symptoms to drones transporting blood samples. As confirmed infections continue to rise in Ghana, reaching over 6,000 cases and more than 30 deaths, health tech experts want to ensure people have access to needed medicine and doctors. Stacey Knott reports from Accra.
For the last few years, healthcare tech company Redbird has been working to ease the burden on hospitals in Ghana with technology that can help pharmacies diagnose and monitor chronic and tropical diseases, saving user information on an app. Now the company has added a function that helps people diagnose whether they have COVID-19. Users can input symptoms into an app and keep track of their movements to determine if they have been in contact with a confirmed case. Co-founder of Redbird, Andrew Quayle, says organizations can use the app to prevent the coronavirus from spreading in the workplace.
Even post-COVID, in quote, organizations are going to have to come back to work, right? And you're going to have to find a safe way of coming back to work, right? Not every organization can work remotely. So this is something that is moving ahead and helping organizations to sort of like plan this and be able to say, okay, I know my people, okay, we're going to be back in 2 weeks. I want to know everyone, like, who's been in touch with a COVID patient. Like, okay, you don't need to come. Like, let's not risk it for the other people.
With a shortage of healthcare facilities across Ghana and to encourage social distancing, Ghana's doctors have looked to technology to consult patients remotely. Dr. Emmeline Opuku has started consulting patients via a mobile application, which she sees as a way to provide healthcare while ensuring people stay home as much as possible.
When the pandemic started, I noticed that most of the people were scared to come to the clinics and the hospitals because they thought that they were going to get the infection from there. So then Talamus reached out to me. And they were like, how about we take this opportunity to use telemedicine as a form to reach our patients?
Talamus is a company set up by a Ghanaian doctor who lives in the US. Country manager for Talamus Ghana, Joshua Owusu-Ansa, says the app Opuku is using is part of his organization's mobile health platform where all aspects of a patient's healthcare can be accessed digitally. He says COVID-19 has underscored the need to utilize technology for healthcare.
I think it's going to be an eye-opener to show Ghanaians and Africans especially that there's less stressful ways of doing things. So this is one of the eye-openers that's going to show us that we need to leverage technology to do some things.
Perhaps the most famous example of healthcare tech in Ghana is the Silicon Valley company Zipline's use of drones to transport medicine and blood samples. Since the pandemic started, drones have been carrying samples from suspected COVID-19 patients to laboratories in big cities to speed up diagnosis and help authorities keep track of any outbreaks. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Accra.
Enough. For Daybreak Africa's Sports, here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin the sports in Kenya, where former Leeds manager Eddie Rambo has been made the first head coach of Kenya's National Rugby League side. Rambo played on the wings for Leeds in the 1990s and was the first Kenyan to play rugby league when he signed in England at Headingley and went on to play for both Drewsbury and Featherstone. The 53-year-old has extensive experience as a player and coach in both codes and is determined to spread the word of rugby league to Kenya. Staying with Kenya, former Harambee Stars coach Adel Amurushi says Football Kenya Federation have yet again failed to pay him his dues within the deadline as directed by the world governing body FIFA. The Belgian, who currently is the Botswana national team coach, has won successive cases of unlawful dismissal against the Football Kenya Federation at FIFA's dispute chambers and the Court of Arbitration for Sports. He was then awarded about $1 million as compensation and damages in 2018, but FKF have appeared unwilling or unable to pay, even defaulting on three separate deadlines set by FIFA, with the latest being on April the 24th. And now to South Africa, where Cricket South Africa has outlined plans to get the game moving again in dealing with the challenges that the COVID-19 pandemic has presented. In a telepress conference that featured CSA's acting chief executive, Dr. Jack Fool, director of cricket, Grammy Smith, and chief medical officer, Dr. Shayub Manjara, as well as South African Cricketers Association CEO, Andrew Bezeki, the officials revealed some of the strategies to help kickstart the sport again in the country. Amongst the key announcements was a support fund to help those in distress during the current climate, as well as ongoing plans for the Proteas, the South African national cricket team, to host India in the coming months. Cricket South Africa acting chief executive Dr. Jack Fool says it is unlikely that the upcoming season will begin as scheduled. Elsewhere in East Africa, Uganda has become the latest nation to approve the cancellation of their country's women's football league due to the coronavirus pandemic. The Federation of Uganda Football Association has revealed the women's top flight has been cancelled without a champion or relegation, having only played the first of their three rounds this season before the COVID-19 outbreak. This cancellation means there are no champions or relegation of any teams from the Football Uganda Federation Association Women's Super League following the nation's football body's decision to abruptly declare an end to the country's 2019-2020 football season on Wednesday. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, May 22nd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.
Listen to Issues in the News, where you will hear a panel of prominent Washington journalists deliberate the latest developments on the world's top stories. Join moderator Michael Williams, Washington contributor to CBS Radio, Nahal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent for Politico, and Josh Glancy, Washington bureau chief for the Sunday Times, this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to deep life, bonga flavor to sukus, afrobeat to dumbolo and makosa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.